This is your life, episode 74. This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life. Is everything you dreamed it would be when the world was younger and you had everything? Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt, and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. In this episode, we'll be talking about 13 ways to frustrate those you lead. Now, you probably worked for somebody that was frustrating, maybe even exasperating, but I want to talk about how to avoid that with the people you're trying to lead. And you can find the outline, the resource links, and a complete transcript, word for word, in the show notes at michaelhyatt.com/74. I'll be back in a minute with my thoughts on this topic.
If you have something to say or sell in today's noisy world,
now you can get the inspiration, training, and tools you need to increase your influence and impact.
Platform University, a community of like-minded individuals led by one of Forbes magazine's top 50 social media influencers, Michael Hyatt.
Each month, you'll get access to
The Masterclass, where Michael interviews leading platform authorities.
Backstage Pass, a behind-the-scenes look at Michael's own platform business.
Member Makeover, with specific recommendations you can put to work now.
A live Q&A session where you can ask Michael your most burning questions.
And the discussion forum where our members support one another in their common quest.
I'm Nicole from Indianapolis, Indiana. For me, the most valuable aspect of Platform University is the ability to ask questions. The idea that people aren't too far away. I can reach out and get a hold of them virtually and ask a question. So the fact that somebody is there to offer assistance.
Intrigued? Now it is the time to invest in building your own platform, platformuniversity.com.
You know, education comes in surprising ways, and sometimes we think we could learn best if we had a better boss or we were following a better leader, right? But sometimes, and this is just the truth, we learn the most from the bad ones, the bad bosses, the ones that seem incompetent or the ones that are even rude or belligerent. Well, the good news for me is I've had lots of those kinds of bosses, some real doozies in my past. Let me just tell you about two quickly. One was a guy named Joe who ran a small engine repair shop called the Motor Shop. And I don't know what's become of him because I haven't kept up with him through the years. But when I began to work for him, I felt like I was walking on eggshells. You know, this was one of those guys that could just violently explode. Being very unpredictable, I didn't know what to expect from day to day. Well, I hadn't worked there too long when I asked him a question about a small engine part that a customer was trying to get replaced. And I'm so mechanically uninclined. I don't really understand a lot about that. I really had no business working in this store, but I was. So I asked Joe for a little help. I said, look, I'm trying to find this part. And I was looking in this big book. I couldn't find it. And he said, look, and I said this in front of the customer. He said in front of everybody else. He said, look, I'm going to show you one more time. And with that, he shut up the book that I was looking at, turned around to the counter or behind the counter, grabbed another one of these big parts books from another manufacturer, thumped it onto the countertop and began to rifle through it and then pointed to the part and said, this is the part. Don't make me show you again. Well, it was humiliating. I was embarrassed not only with the customer, but with some other employees that happened to be in the room, and I felt like an idiot. And the truth was, he was just being a jerk. Fast forward a number of years, I was working for another boss who was a little bit different than that, a little more sophisticated, but similar, in that I always felt like I was walking around eggshells. And fortunately, I had learned by this time to be careful, and I never ran afoul of him. But a lot of my peers, a lot of subordinates, even my bosses, those people I saw in public situations get completely undressed by this guy. He was rude. He was indignant. He was sometimes thoughtless. But the maddening part of it was that there were times when he could be charming. So It always kept you on your feet. Just when you thought he wouldn't strike, he would. But, you know, I learned a lot from him. I learned that I wanted to be more predictable, that I didn't want to be that kind of boss, that I wanted to be someone who is even tempered so that when my employees, when the people I was trying to lead would come to me, that they would know what to expect. But the great thing about bosses like this is that they taught me, and they'll probably teach you, what not to do, which is just as important as what to do. It's just more painful. So just for fun, I thought I'd share these lessons with you, these 13 lessons as positives rather than negatives. So here's the idea. If your goal is to frustrate, maybe even exasperate your employees, here are 13 ways to do it. And again, keep in mind, these are tongue-in-cheek. Number one, don't be responsive. In other words, when the people that are working for you leave you a voicemail message or send you a message, email message, don't respond to it right away. Just kind of leave them wondering. Make them wonder if you ever got the message, or maybe you're mad at them, or you're not going to respond in a timely fashion. This kind of impedes their work and keeps them from moving the ball down the field. So don't be responsive. Number two, cancel meetings at the last minute. This is a terrific way to frustrate your employees. Used to happen to me a lot with a manager that I worked for in the publishing business, and we worked in two different buildings. So I would drive over to my weekly meeting with him. I would get there. He would keep me waiting for a bit, and then his assistant would say, "Gosh, I'm sorry, Michael, but," and I won't mention his name for fear of outing him here, but she said, "He's going to have to cancel for today." So I would have to pick up all my stuff. I would have to trudge back to my other building, and I wasted probably 30 minutes in that process. He just wasn't considerate, and he just canceled those meetings at the last minute. It wasn't just me, but as I checked with my peers, he had a habit of doing this as kind of a way of life. Number three, reprimand them in front of their peers. You know, this is a great way to take the wind out of anybody's sails. Rather than doing it in private, where you might, you know, still maintain their dignity and give them the privilege of coming back and giving a little bit of give and take and maybe enlightening you or enlarging your perspective, just do this in front of everybody where you can really embarrass them and make them feel small or diminish them. So reprimand them in front of their peers. Number four, change your mind frequently. Now, don't be too quick to do this. Do this only after the people on your team have invested a lot of time, a lot of energy, and hopefully a lot of money or a lot of their budget in the project, and then just kind of willy-nilly change your mind. And it's even better if you don't explain why. Leave them guessing. Just change your mind, be capricious, and this will keep them on their toes. Number five, don't bother stating your expectations. Be vague. Be general. Let them guess. And I would try to do this on the front end, but when it comes time for their annual review, be very specific, be very measurable. That way they don't have a chance of achieving what you've articulated because you didn't articulate it. You didn't articulate your expectations. You just left them to guess. Boy, I've had bosses like that before who I never really knew what they wanted. They couldn't tell me what they wanted. They could only tell me when I did something they didn't like. And it was a tremendous waste of time and an energy. And I never felt like I was doing a good job or getting ahead. Number six, always ask for what they don't have with them. In other words, if they bring to a meeting with you a whole bunch of detail about a decision that they want you to make, then ask for a summary. And I had a boss that did this one time who would say often to me, he would say, "Well, you don't expect me to wade through all that detail, do you? Give me a summary." Then if I brought the summary, then he would say, "Well, where's the backup? I can't make a decision just based on the summary. I have to have all the backup." Well, after a while, I caught on and I brought both. But one way to frustrate your employees or frustrate the people you're leading is always ask them for stuff. That one note, that one random thing that you weren't scheduled to talk about, ask them for that information just so you kind of, again, keep them guessing. Number seven, focus on superficial things rather than the substance. Like, for example, are they at work exactly on time? Are they wearing exactly the right clothes? Focus on style over substance rather than things like, you know, how productive they are or what the work is or are they getting the work done or not or are they being effective? Focus on these superficial cultural things that in the end probably don't matter that much. Number 8, assign them work, then micromanage the process. You probably know people like this. Maybe you've been this person. I know I have, and I've been on the receiving end of it, and it's not fun when someone is micromanaging you. I had a boss early in my career who was a wonderful guy. He was kind of a legend in our industry, was very pleasant. He's gone now. But he would constantly micromanage me. I mean, he would assign me something and then like the day later come in and check up with me to see how far along I'd gotten or how I was doing it. My view as a leader is that when you make assignments, don't really be focused on how it gets done, you know, as long as it's under the umbrella of being ethical. Let them use their own methods. Let them use their own strategies, but focus on the output or the results. This guy did neither. And I was very frustrated. And frankly, I eventually quit and moved to another company because I just couldn't handle it. I don't work well that way. It communicated to me a lack of trust, and I just couldn't work in that situation, so I quit. Number 9, do all the talking. You know, when the employee comes to your office, you talk, because after all, you're their supervisor, you're their superior, you know more than they do, you're smarter than they are, you're funnier than they are, so obviously, you're the one that should do all the talking, right? Well, not so much. You know, I think good leaders do the exact opposite. They ask questions. They elicit feedback. They facilitate a conversation, but they don't feel like they've got to have all the answers or be the smartest guy or gal in the room. Number 10, never recognize them. Let them do a lot of work. Don't acknowledge it. Don't reward it. And don't publicly recognize it. And then just keep raising the bar so that just when they think they've done a good job and are worthy of some praise, then raise the bar and teach them that they're not so worthy. You know, and I've had bosses that have done this. You probably have too, where you've worked like crazy. It's gone unrecognized. The boss had no idea the time and the effort that you put into that project and just passed over it like it was nothing. You know, nothing is quite as disheartening as that experience. Number 11, catch them doing something wrong. I mean, there's a lot of things that they're probably doing right, but why focus on that? Instead, narrow in your focus, really focus on the thing that they're doing wrong and call attention to that. That'll teach them a lesson. Just like when you're trying to potty train a puppy, rub their nose in it. That's what you need to do with the people that you're leading. Not. You know, that is not a good way to lead because you're going to get more of what you acknowledge, more of what you focus on, more of what you catch them doing. Better to catch them doing things that are right. Number 12, communicate that you are the fount of all wisdom. And this is a little bit like doing all the talking. You know, let them know that you've got the answers. And if you want their opinion, you'll give it to them. I'm just kidding. You've got to recognize that all of us are smarter than some of us. All of us are smarter than I am. All of them are smarter than you are. And when you lead a team like that, and find the wisdom in the collective group, you're going to be that much smarter, that much wiser, and that much more likely to succeed. And then number 13, and I've saved the best for last, be moody. Like the boss I talked about at the top of this segment, where we would go into his executive suite and we'd always ask his assistant, what's the weather today? And by that, we meant, is the boss in a good mood? You know, is he friendly? Is he warm? Is he in a good place? Or is he in one of those mercurial times where he's moody and likely to say no to anything that we propose? We wanted to know what the weather is. And I'm going to tell you, if you're moody with the people that you're leading, it's a very unnerving thing. You're not going to get the best work out of them. They're going to be frustrated. You're going to wonder what's happened. But I think it's much better to set an even emotional climate. It doesn't mean you have to be up all the time or rah-rah all the time, but just predictable. You know, this creates the kind of certainty and the kind of trust that you need to create the best possible culture for your company, for your ministry, for your people. Well, there you have it. And if for some crazy reason you don't want to frustrate those you lead, you can just invert these suggestions and do the exact opposite. Now, here's the question for you. What are some of the ways you've seen leaders frustrate those that they lead? Leave your answer at michaelhyatt.com/74. There are the show notes, and there's a place where you can leave your comment. I would love to hear from you, and I'd love to learn from you, and I know the greater community would as well. I'll be back after the break with our listener Q&A segment.
Thinking of starting your own blog but worried that your technical know-how is not up to scratch?
The good news is that starting blogging has never been easier.
Michael shares his knowledge with you for free and will show you that 20 minutes is all it takes to have your own blog up and running.
Thanks for the step-by-step description. I had been thinking for months about starting my own blog. I saw your instructions and just finished signing up and creating my first blog post.
Michael, thanks so much for this information. You've taken a very complicated sounding project and made it simple and easy to understand.
Join Michael and follow his quick and easy step-by-step video tutorial at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress setup.
Take action now and start blogging today.
michaelhyatt.com/WordPress setup.
We had a variety of questions this week, and the first one comes from Allison. It's a little bit long, and I want to ask you to hang in there because it's really an important question, and it's probably one that you struggle with or somebody that you know and probably love struggles with. So give it a listen. Allison?
Hi, Michael. My name is Allison Levitt. My husband, Lev, makes professional flutes at levittflutes.com. We're in the midst of starting our third year running our own business and are beginning to realize that we need to maybe move from the sprint-like pace that we had the first 2 years to maybe something a little easier, like a marathon pace. I don't know. And we're wondering what advice you have for us on how to start thinking about how to handle all the things we need to do and also to get a little bit more balance into this. We need to not only take care of the business and also make sure that we take care of all the aspects of the business. My husband would love to make flutes all day. He would like not to do invoices. How to handle my job outside of the house, where I'm a public school administrator, and my very, very part-time educational consulting job. We have three very active kids in middle school and elementary school who need to be taken care of. We'd like to be starting to take better care of our health, spend some time together as a couple, going out to dinner, have a social life again. And while everybody completely was on board to put their shoulder to the wheel for that first 2 years and really make some sacrifices in time and focus and activities, we really need to figure out how to transition to something a little bit more sustainable for all of us. How do we begin that conversation, and what advice do you have for us as we begin that? Because we've loved having the business, and we want to continue to love it and not get all burnt out by it. I really have enjoyed your podcast and your blog, and can't wait to hear what you have to say to us. Thanks so much. Bye.
Yeah, if I could summarize this, Allison, it's essentially this. How can we make time for the important non-work stuff in our lives? Because oftentimes, we experience the tyranny of the urgent, the things that are not that important, but seem urgent to us and demand our action now, consume our time, and squeeze out the space that we'd really like to devote to some of those other important activities, many of which you mentioned in your question. Let me recommend a couple of posts that I have on my blog for you, and I think they'll be helpful to you. The first one is called Put the Big Rocks in First. Now, this is a short video clip from Stephen Covey, where he does a very famous illustration of putting the big rocks in a clear plastic bucket and then putting the smaller rocks in after that. And it's obviously a metaphor for if you're going to make time for the things that are important, you've got to schedule and plan those into your schedule first. Otherwise, the little rocks, the small things, the less important things take over. Now, I have to say that if you go to that post, and there's a link in the show notes, you might find that that video is not available. I just checked it this morning and had to replace it because the owner of that video clip keeps deleting it from YouTube, and it keeps getting replaced by other people, which is kind of a, by the way, just parenthetically, kind of a silly thing, because all this does is promotes Stephen Covey's work and encourages people to buy his books and other materials. But regardless, it's their property. I respect that. They can do what they want. But regardless, I have a blog post there that is kind of my thoughts on the Covey illustration. So even if you can't find the video clip, go ahead and read the notes there. It'll tell you most of what you need to know. And you might also look on YouTube if you can't find the clip on the blog post with the link in my show notes. You might just look on YouTube and search for Big Rocks and Stephen Covey, and you might find a link that actually does work. The next question comes from David.
Hi, Michael. This is David Royale from the greenleafblog.blogspot.ca. I really appreciate your blog, and I'd just like to ask you, is it really worth the time to use Twitter? if I don't have many contacts on that platform to begin with? And just what are your thoughts about that? Thank you very much.
Well, David, it's no secret that I'm a Twitter enthusiast. I love Twitter, but that's also where my tribe is. Now, I've got some on Facebook, a few on Google+, a few on LinkedIn. But the thing that I would like to say to you is that you need to be on the social media networks where you think most of your target audience is going to be, your contacts, your prospects, and so forth. There's no obligation to be on any of them. You know, the one you need to be on is the one where you're most likely to interact with the people that you want to do business with. And in fact, I would say you don't have to be active on all of them. Pick the one that you that resonates with you the most, or where you're going to find your target prospects the most, and go there and get active. Now, if that's Twitter, fine. But if it's not, don't worry about it. Move to Facebook or move to LinkedIn or one of the other social media networks. Don't labor under the burden that there's one that's better than the rest of them. And you'll find enthusiasts who will claim that, you know, Twitter's better than Facebook, or five reasons why Facebook is better than LinkedIn, or whatever. Don't believe them. It's all relative to the context of what your business is and where your prospects are. And that's how I think about it. The next question comes from Matt.
Hey, Michael, it's Matt McWilliams from mattmcwilliams.com. And I've written a lot about my experience, mostly failures as a leader. And when I built a company from the ground up years ago, it seemed like I kind of woke up one day and we went from 4 people to 50. And I was completely in over my head. And what I needed more than anything was training, and I needed time, but I had neither. So I'm curious, what advice would you give the 26-year-old me? Thanks a ton.
Matt, this is a terrific question. And I've been in this situation before, just like you have, where the business was exploding and it didn't seem like I had time, to quote him again, Stephen Covey, to sharpen the saw. And if you're not familiar with that book, you should read the book where he talks about, which is called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's a classic, one of the best personal development books I've ever read in my life. And I've got a link in the show notes to the book. But the thing he talks about there is sharpening the saw, you know, and think of this as a metaphor if you're trying to cut the grass. You know, if you spend all your time cutting the grass with the mower and never take time to sharpen the saw, it's going to take you longer and longer to cut the grass. It's going to make you less effective and less efficient. Much better to stop, push the pause button, go ahead and sharpen the blade so that you're more efficient and more effective when you're actually cutting the grass. And the same is true when you're running a business. If you don't take time for personal development, for learning productivity, this is going to catch up with you. And the best place to do that, in my view, the thing that's worked for me is to do that first thing in the morning. I sharpen the saw first thing in the morning, almost every morning. You know, I don't have an immaculate track record. I occasionally miss. I missed a couple days this last week. But I try to be on that every day to sharpen the saw because I want to be at my best. I want to be at my most efficient. One little tip, get a good night's rest. I know it's easy to think you're going to cheat the system and you're going to go ahead and try to get by with less sleep. But in my experience, I'm generally less focused, less efficient, less productive. I spend a lot of time spinning my wheels when I'm tired. So it's kind of a false economy. You look like you're saving time by getting by in less sleep. You're actually spending more time by trying to cheat the system. So that's what I would suggest. You just got to make time for it. If I were talking to the 26-year-old version of you, Matt, I would just say, look, I'm sorry. Let's get this on the schedule. You've got to make, you know, whether it's 30 minutes or an hour to sharpen the saw. Because if you don't take care of your spirit, if you don't take care of yourself emotionally and intellectually and physically, you're going to eventually break down. You know, you're going to blow out your marriage. Your health is going to fail. Something else is going to give, and it's just not worth it. This is a long distance race. This is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And in most cases, in those situations where everything seems so urgent, we need to remind ourselves that all we're doing is whatever our business is. We're probably not working in an ER room. Maybe you are, but most of you aren't. You're not working in an ER room where lives are at stake. You're just, and my daughter used to tell me this, Dad, you're just making books. I mean, it's true. You know, I wasn't saving lives. There was nothing that in the short term was really at stake. And therefore, it gave me a sense of perspective. And that's what you need most of all as a 26-year-old. But candidly, you need that in every season of your life. The last question comes from Ree.
Hi, Michael. My name is Ree Klein, and my site is escapingdodge.com. As a full-time blogger who has yet to monetize my site, I often meet professionals who tell me about their programs that can help. I do invest in personal development. Case in point, I just attended the SCORE conference, which was amazing, but I can't take every paid program that comes my way. How can I gracefully decline to participate without making the other person feel like I don't value what they have to offer? I'm looking forward to your words of wisdom.
Thanks, Ree. This is a terrific question. I've faced this many times, as recently as in the last year, where somebody that I knew and love had a training opportunity, really wanted me to go through it, and I was beginning to feel pressured. One of the things I do there, and I do this for charitable giving as well, but I try to take the pressure off by giving myself some space. And again, this seems like the Stephen Covey theme hour, but one of the things that he talks about in the Seven Habits is putting some space between the stimulus and the response. This is what makes us human, and this is what gives us an opportunity to choose our response and choose the best possible response. So to say to somebody who's trying to get you to make a buying decision, and that's what this is, to just say to them, especially on a training opportunity, hey, this sounds terrific. Let me give it some thought. The truth is, I only do about two of these a year, and so I try to be very intentional and very deliberate about it. And certainly yours is one I want to consider, but I've got several others that I'm considering at this time, and I want to make the best decision possible for what I need right now. That kind of puts them on notice that, A, you're not going to give them an answer right now. Number two, they're in competition with a lot of other opportunities. Number three, you're not going to be able to choose everything. There's a lot of good opportunities. There are more opportunities than you have time or money. And number four, you're going to take the initiative and you're going to make this decision on your own time frame. I do the same thing when people pressure me about charitable giving. And I have a lot of people that approach me with, you know, frankly, very worthy causes. All of them are terrific. All of them are difficult to say no to. And so what I try to do is the same thing. Gail and I plan our giving out a year in advance, and I'm able to legitimately say to other people, say, look, that sounds like a terrific opportunity and a very worthy cause. I'm honored that you would ask me. The way that Gail and I think about our charitable giving, or the way that we do that, is that we try to plan in a year in advance. So we're going to soon be considering what our giving is going to look like for this next year. We'd be happy to consider your opportunity. If you could send me something either in the mail or preferably by email, we'll put in the hopper with all the other requests, and we'll prayerfully consider this one and make a decision. We only do two or three charities a year, so we by necessity have to limit it. We really want to focus our resources and make as big a difference as we can with a few opportunities, but we'd be glad to consider yours if you would submit it to us. Again, that does the very same thing. Puts them on notice, gives you some space so that you can make the best decision possible. So nobody likes to say no, but the truth is, if you're going to be effective, you've got to say no. And in the training area, the thing I would say to you there also, Ree, and I faced it this year, you can only absorb so much. The issue probably for you, if you're like me, is not that you need more creative ideas or more information or more skills or more knowledge. Yes, that would help. But what you probably need is more execution on what you already know. And so this is one of the things that I've been saying lately to people that have approached me. I've just said, look, I'm not doing any more training this year. The truth is, I'm trying to implement and execute on what I've already learned this year. And that's something maybe I'll consider this next year. And I don't think anybody will begrudge you for that. I think most people understand that you've got a lot of options, a lot of opportunities, and if they're not respectful of that, they're probably not worthy of being your friend. So I draw the boundary. Well, that's all the time we have for questions this week. But before I share my tip of the week with you, tomorrow is Thanksgiving in the U.S., and I'm running, just like most retailers out there, a Black Friday special. And I'm running the special on my course, Get Published, which is a 21-session audio course. And if you've ever thought about writing a book but didn't know where to start, this course is for you. Or even if you've already written a book but want to do everything you can to make the biggest splash you can in the marketplace, this course will give you the tools you need to make it happen. As I mentioned, the course contains 21 audio sessions, everything I've learned about publishing in my 30 years in the industry as a publisher, most recently CEO of Thomas Nelson Publishers, but as a literary agent and as a two-time New York Times bestselling author. But here's the deal. The course normally sells for $397. However, I'm offering a $200 discount for this Black Friday weekend only. Now, the offer is going to extend through Cyber Monday on December the 2nd, but it ends at midnight on Monday, December the 2nd, Central Standard Time. But again, until then, you can get it just for $197. This is an unbelievable bargain. You can find out more at michaelhyatt.com/Black Friday. michaelhyatt.com/Black Friday. Now, let me leave you with one final tip. I've been struggling this winter to get my exercise in. It's been unbelievably cold, at least for Nashville, Tennessee, and I've been really tempted to stay indoors. Well, I got to thinking about this, and I've got a friend who started counting their steps and really using it as a way to motivate themselves to walk more, just the natural walking patterns they have. And the truth is, I really do walk a lot. I walk to my office, which is about 3 blocks from my home, but I can go on several different routes, some of them longer. And I thought if I could motivate myself to choose the longer route sometimes, I can probably get some exercise in without a lot of effort. So at first I looked for applications on the iPhone. I looked at two applications, one called Moves, and I've got a link in the show notes, which was pretty cool because it tracks where you go, not just how many steps, but where you go, and it uses GPS to identify those. I got a little bit frustrated with it because it didn't seem to be consistent, but a lot of people have reported great results with it. I tried another one called Runtastic, and again, a link in the show notes for that one. The only problem with that was I tried to enroll Gail in this process because I said, let's do this together, and she actually was pretty excited about it. The problem was that as a woman, she said, look, I don't normally have pockets, and I don't have a way to keep my phone with me all the time. So then I started looking at something I'd heard about, and I'd actually had an earlier version of this, but I started looking at the Fitbit Flex, which is like a wristwatch. It just fits on your the wrist of your non-dominant hand. So in my case, that's my left hand, and it tracks every move. The beautiful thing about it is that it syncs via Bluetooth with your iPhone, and you can sync it up also with the desktop version of that, the browser version of that, but I love just doing it on my iPhone. It's $99, and you might also want to look at sort of the big brother of that, which is called the Fitbit Force. What I've been telling you about is the Fitbit Flex, but the Force model is twice as expensive, almost twice as expensive. It's $190, but it includes a display of the time, and this was attractive to me because I broke my wristwatch this last week, but unfortunately, I ordered the Flex, and I'm not going to return it. I'm just going to continue to use it. There were a few negative reviews on the Amazon site about the Force as well. Your mileage may vary, but like anything you buy like this, you know, I would encourage you to read the reviews. But we are having a blast with this. It tracks our steps. We're able to track how much water we're drinking using the little app that's on the iPhone. And we can track our sleep. So, you know, how many times we woke up during the night. That's just kind of fun to see whether we're getting better quality of sleep, because at the end of the day, that's really what you want as well. It's not just about how long you sleep, but the quality of your sleep as well. Well, that's it for this episode of This Is Your Life. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please show the love by going to michaelhyatt.com/love and tweeting a link to the show. I'd be so grateful. That would help us get the word out. And if you'd rate the podcast on iTunes this week, that would also be extremely helpful. It's very easy, and it gets the visibility of my podcast up in iTunes search. So until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Now go make it count.